Salut à toi, Chaudière Allemande. Salut à toi, le Vietnamien. Salut à toi, le Cambodgien. Salut à toi, le Japonais. Salut à toi, le Thaïlandais. Salut à toi, le Laotien. Salut à toi, le...
From WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, January 14th. As the Florida legislature is gearing up for this year's session, a Clearwater-based think tank has produced a report that shows the proportion of the crisis for owners of aging condos. New state regulations that kicked in January 1st mean looming financial disaster for the owners of 1.1 million condos in the state older than 30 years. The report by the Florida Policy Project titled "The Future of Florida Condos: Facts and Statistics" shows how many owners are facing evictions or forced sales, how individual buyers are staying away, leaving just investor buyers, how those developer buyers are stymied by legal battles, and how older condos, once the backbone of affordable housing in Florida, are no longer a solution. You can find the complete study at no cost at floridapolicyproject.com. The Florida Policy Project is planning a second report with policy recommendations set to be released before the March legislative session. Yesterday morning, in a press conference, Governor Ron DeSantis called on the Florida legislature to gather at the end of this month in a special legislative session to address immigration. Within just hours, the Republican leaders of the Florida House and Senate pushed back. In a letter issued shortly after 5 on Monday, Senate President Ben Alberton and House Speaker Daniel Perez said discussing immigration would be premature and that they won't cooperate. Alberton and Perez said in the letter it was, quote, completely irresponsible to get out ahead of any announcements President Trump will make, unquote. In November, the two leaders told reporters that immigration policy comes from the federal government, not the states. If you're headed north on US 301 from Sarasota to Bradenton, expect delays in the next couple of months. The Florida Department of Transportation has begun a $30 million improvement project for 7.5 miles of US 301 from Tallahassee to the junction with US 41 near downtown Bradenton. Yesterday, FDOT announced the temporary closure of a northbound lane on the bridge that swings over US 41 in Bradenton. The entire US 301 project is to be completed early this year. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, January 14th.
Good morning. You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Happy New Year, everyone. This is the Healthy Living Hour, airing live every other Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time. My name is Rebecca, and I am your host. A huge thanks to our fill-in soundboard operator, Leon, our program manager. Leon, thanks for helping a gal out today. Our goal is to offer a wide variety of topics and guests to better inform and educate our community on current health and wellness issues. As a disclaimer, everything said here today is uncensored, can be extremely diverse, and does not necessarily reflect the views of WSLR, nor their staff or volunteers. Further, no one here is providing any type of medical diagnosis, treatment, nor advice. Everything said here on the Healthy Living Hour is solely for general information and to foster critical thinking. We encourage you to consult your doctor for personal medical advice. Good morning, everyone. It's so good to be here at the station again. And today, I always have special guests, but I have, to me, one of my, who I think is perhaps one of the best human beings in this community. Oh, we have Andrew Hudson with us today, and he's old hat at this. He's been interviewed numerous times. Anyway, I met Andrew at one of the founder of WSLR's, a small gathering, and he showed up to this little dinner gathering, and he had braids of sweetgrass that he gave to all of us, and it was just so special. And just hearing him talk and the change that he's fostering in local communities is very meaningful and significant, and I think we need more of that. And so here to encourage us and perhaps motivate us is Andrew. And Andrew is a, for those of you who don't know, Andrew is a Mennonite pastor and organic farmer currently based in Sarasota, Florida. His work involves leadership at our very own Jessica's Organic Farm. He puts his two vocations together in Sabbath gardening, supporting congregations and using biblically informed gardening to deepen their relationship with the land where they worship. He has a grown son and lives in community with Chosen Family. Andrew, thanks so much for being here. And would you just give us a tell us a little bit about your background or sure. share a story?
Sure. Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm from Oregon originally. I go back seven generations there, and so I'm a long ways from family, and I get back when I can, but this is my chosen home, and it's great to be here. But I grew up the child and grandchild of people who worked in the church and did gardening. My grandma was born in the Congo. Her parents were missionaries, and there they grew their own food, and she did that for her whole life. So I was really shaped by being in my grandma's garden growing up, and she was part of the organics movement in the 60s and 70s in Oregon. Oregon is one of the first places where they had organic certification, and she really believed in having a standard that the public could know. So I've been connected to organic farming and gardening my whole life.
This is in your blood.
It's really in my blood.
and in your genetics.
And so when life took me to Sarasota, where I hardly knew anybody, I was doing remodeling, construction stuff, but I started hanging out at Jessica's because it was the place culturally that felt most familiar. And I got to know everybody, and my son started playing with the people who are now my bosses, the people who are taking over the farm. And eventually somebody said, well, why don't you just work there? You're there all the time. And so I started learning from Bill Pisher, who's a master at what he does. And I've been there since 2008 now.
Wow, that's wonderful. And so we're going to talk about, I think, a number of things, one of them being the importance of organic farming. How about we start there? Like, we know that we are just inundated with chemicals and pesticides and all this processed stuff. Everything's boxed and meant to stay on a shelf. You know, Twinkies outlive us all, basically. Chemicals, I mean, you know, when I go, you know, to shop, you know, you look at these things and man, they're great marketers. You know, they have great marketing. They look great. They sound great. They make this packaging look healthy, but is it really, you know? And you look at the back of the ingredients and there's probably 25 ingredients in there, maybe 80% you can't pronounce, let alone know what it is. You have to Google it or look it up. So there is this thing. And, you know, I think, you know, we're both of the perhaps mindset that our bodies just weren't designed to handle all this and to process this? You know, if food is fuel, you know, what are we fueling our bodies? You know, that this is our meat suit, right? You know, it's our vehicle for something more meaningful. And so what are we doing exactly? And could you talk to us a little bit about your thoughts on this organic, you know, movement? I know, and I'll just share a quick little story. I remember probably about 15 years ago going into a Publix and, you know, buying a bag of organic apples. And, you know, cashier is checking them out. And she did a double take on the price. And, you know, maybe it was $7 or $8 for a bag of apples. And she kind of looked funny, like, wow, can that be? And she goes, oh, they're organic. And I'm like, yeah, we should have to pay more for the chemicals, don't you think? You know, this is a little backwards. It's a lot upside down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, there's a couple levels to what you were just saying. I mean, first of all, one of the reasons I'm a big fan of your show is I think this kind of thing just has to be said over and over because we are inundated with unhelpful messages, so we have to repeat the helpful messages. And so I really appreciate that you put the work into just saying, like a lot of what you just said, I think is obvious. I think almost everybody would agree with it, and yet we don't behave that way, and it's because of industries that benefit from us not doing what's in our interests. So, you know, it just needs to be said over and over. The thing that I want to repeat that you were sort of implying is it takes more effort and it costs more often, not always, but it often costs more to take raw foods and cook with them rather than take something packaged. But it's worth it. You're happier, it tastes better. It's just really important to emphasize, yes, it's worth the effort, because people, I just hear it from everybody, when they get good local foods and they cook with them, they love, they're so happy they did it. So it just has to be repeated over and over. You asked about organics. Okay. So, you know, my family was involved in starting up in small ways in the movement for organic foods to be a sort of standard that you could count on. It's important to note that organics became the huge organizing principle, but there are several good ones. And so I want to come back to that. So I want to talk about organics and then say that's not the only concept that we can work with here, you know. But it is the one that became the big social movement going back to the 60s and 70s in some parts of the country. So there was this movement to have a standard so that if you go to some town you've never been before, you don't have to spend years getting to know the farmer to be able to trust that the food is, you know, meeting certain standards. And this is still largely broken out by state to state. So Florida has our own certification agency. It's called QCS, Quality Control Services, I think. Bill Pischer was the chair of the committee that became QCS.
Oh, wow.
So he, in a sense, wrote the original organic standards for Florida. There are a lot of interesting stories there. I can't go into it, but there's so much that went into making that happen at all. It is largely state to state. So Florida, because of the realities in this state, I think it was a wise choice to set the bar fairly low so that you can encourage people to meet that. So the QCS standards are lower than the ones in Oregon. The ones in Oregon are pretty hard to meet. That can be prohibitive to some very good-hearted people. So I'm actually a fan of the way it's done here. So it is largely state to state, and not every state has its own certification agency, but Florida and Georgia do, Oregon and Washington and California do. There's about 25 to 30. And then there's the national one. And you probably remember in the late 90s, the federal government decided to step in and try to have some national standards. And that was one of the moments to celebrate in social movements. And we often forget to celebrate wins. You know, we forget the winds quickly. The food industry wanted to have GMOs approved as part of the organic standards. They wanted to have sewage sludge, which has all sorts of toxins in it, to be able to be approved in organic standards. And there was massive response to that. Hundreds of thousands of comments from people nationally to the USDA to get them to not include those things in the organic standards. And now we have decent national organic standards. So if you get the USDA organic certification, you know, if we really wanted to go into it, I could suggest some improvements to that. But it really is meaningful, and it means something approximately to what the average person would be looking for organics. So it's been a really important win as a social movement. And yeah, I think organics are a really important thing. Got to say, there are other things, and maybe we could go into that, but there are other ways to organize things too. But organic has become that one big thing.
Yeah, and if I can just bring up a story. I'm from Wisconsin, if you can't tell from this accent that I would love to lose. Leon says he's going to help me with that maybe. But my uncle has a little dairy farm, and his cows are like his family. He just treats them, you know, and in a tiny little dairy farm, and he's organic. And, you know, I remember, man, this must have been about 10 years ago. But, you know, there's times of drought, right? You have rainy seasons, and then you might have a summer of a lot of drought. And he was contracted with one of the organic milk, you know, places. I don't remember which one. But during this drought, you know, none of the milks were producing, or the cows were producing their quota, you know, so none of the farmers were able to meet the quota for these milk trucks that came around. And he asked the driver of the truck, like, well, we're all dry, you know, what are you doing? He says, oh, I just went up to the other town to the, you know, maybe Miller Farm and got some. And my uncle was a little shocked. He's like, well, they use that bovine growth hormone, you know, and they're not quite the certified. And the driver basically just threw up his hands, like shrugged his shoulders, like, well, there's nothing I can do about that. So I guess the question is, you know, he brought it up, like, how do you trust it when these things are happening? And hopefully they're very rare, but yeah.
Well, I want to clarify, just ask a clarifying question about your story. So this was a certified organic milk sort of cooperative of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And their driver was going outside the fold, so to speak.
Correct.
And getting some RGBH or, you know, some tainted milk in some
tainted
way.
Tainted milk, yeah.
Well, I mean, the system, first of all, does depend on people telling the truth.
Right.
If people lie, they can do that because you only get inspected once a year, and that inspection is of your documentation. So the inspection, at least in Florida, I got to say, I don't know about other states. That's why it's important to say it is largely state to state.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't speak to Wisconsin, but in Florida, you're inspected of your records, but they really go through the records and they try to sniff out if there's anything that's not authentic. Yeah, I couldn't just go in the day before and write up a bunch of records and hand it to the guy. But that, I don't know how to speak to that problem because we just produce everything on site, so we're not dependent. Well, that's not true. We get hay from off site. And we get a document from the person that says this has not been sprayed with pesticides and fungicides or whatever. That guy could lie to us. So, you know, just like so many things in economics, trust is a big issue.
Yeah, anything.
And I would say also when there are problems with scaling up anything. And so that is a problem of scaling up, right? It's multiple farms. Now, usually just a few farms, you know, I mean, for one thing, they're going to police each other, just like your relative. That's really interesting. This was your uncle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, on even a larger scale, the farmer wouldn't even care, wouldn't even ask, right? And so there are, at least that had caring for the consumer involved as opposed to large scale. Mm-hmm. I mean, so when I talk about scale, which to me is one of the really significant things, I think of E. coli outbreaks and other disease that happens in the food system. It almost never happens with small local farms. It's almost always a problem of the processing of huge quantities, and they end up, for whatever reason, sitting longer out in the ambient air than they should. That's almost always where you get E. coli outbreaks. So when somebody comes to the farm, this happened. There was an E. coli outbreak in romaine lettuce, and a guy from a TV station came by and wanted to interview me about it. And the first thing I wanted to do was go out in the field and eat romaine on camera, because I am not worried about the romaine in our field. It's if I had way too many workers and they get busy and they leave something sitting out for a day and a half, and then they're going to get in trouble if they left it out, so they cover it up and send it on. That's where we're going to have a disease outbreak. So scale is a big issue. I don't know how to speak. That's a really intriguing example from your uncle, but scale is something we have to watch.
Yeah, and I think, and sorry to mean to kind of throw you, you took a little sucker punch there in this at all, but I should have asked you about that prior, but this comes full circle as to why it's important to support local, you know, and the necessity of that and the protection that's maybe...
Protection, safety. There's safety.
Protection, there's safety in it. Yeah. So, well, thank you. And if I can say, well, let me just take a little moment here. And I also want to say we are live here at WSLR. Our studio line is 941-954-8636. So if you have any questions for Andrew before 10 o'clock, please call in. We'd love to hear from you. And as a little public service announcement, the Literacy Council of Sarasota needs volunteer tutors. Local adults need tutors in Sarasota County. The Literacy Council of Sarasota is offering tutor training workshops starting in January 2025 for volunteers who want to help other adults improve their basic English communication and literacy skills. No previous experience required. Space is limited, and pre-registration is required by this Friday, January 17th. To register or for more information, call Program Director Marcielo Morgado at 941-955-0421, extension 0, or email mmorgado@sarasotaliteracy.org. And again, we're here with Andrew Hudson talking about all things organic farming. And what are some of the other benefits that you see with organic farming? And let's go back, if we can. Let's talk about Jessica. So as probably all of us know, you know, this area was significantly impacted by a number of pretty rough storms, hurricanes, and Jessica's farm was hugely impacted. Can you share some of that, please?
Yeah, sure. When I think back to the past hurricane season, I more and more I'm looking at the bigger picture of the whole season. We actually had three significant hurricanes. Early in the season, we had Hurricane Debbie. And then we had the boom, boom, Milton and Helene before that. All three of those had flooding involved. Each of them was a unique event for us, too. So I'm trying to, now that a little time has elapsed, I'm having to think back. But Debbie and Milton both had a lot of flooding. And so the flooding and the killing of some things that have deeper roots, because they literally drowned in the water, that was a problem in those two. In Helene, it was more the wind. And mm-hmm. I believe Helene is the one that hit us directly. Is that right?
Oh, that was, I think, Milton.
Oh, Milton was the mm-hmm. one that hit us directly.
The last
I
one,
think
the
I,
most recent one.
I think I mixed it up. No, I didn't mix it up. It was Helene where the wind was the problem, even though that didn't hit us directly for whatever reason. Maybe it was that it killed everything so that the wind from Milton didn't have as many things to hit. Anyway, that's just to say hurricanes are more nuanced than we often realize. And so, you know, you have those two things, and then you also have the possibility of storm surge, which, of course, hit a lot of people. We are at 30 feet of elevation, so we actually don't have a storm surge problem. But, yeah, both flooding and wind. Especially when Milton was coming, but even with Helene, we've gone through a transition that I think a lot of people have gone through over the past year or two. And I think it has a huge toll to having more storms in a way that we don't often think about, which is as a business, we had to get so that we went from storms being a sort of stressful holiday. You know, it used to be when a hurricane was coming, businesses would say, look, these are kind of rare. We're just going to take our time and do everything, and we're not going to worry quite about the costs because it's so rare. Now, they're happening so often that we have to have a protocol. And so we do at Jessica's. We have about a six-hour protocol, and that allows us to make sure that the storm's going to hit us before we start doing all this work. And then 6 hours, we take the plastic off the hoop houses and move the flats and whatever. 6 hours in, and then it takes about 6 hours to put things back afterwards. That's been a real improvement and makes hurricanes cost less for us because we're getting good at this. But what it takes out of the process is all the emotional processing. It used to be like you had a little time to process this with people as you go, and now you just got to batten down the hatches and be all business. And I think it takes a toll that I have seen at the farm and other places in terms of people being sick in the aftermath and people just fighting more and being less mentally healthy. So I think there's a big emotional and health toll to the storms happening more often that I haven't heard people recognizing. So I just want to point that out. I've also learned that different plants have different reactions to storms. So cucumbers hate wind. So the wind from Helene killed all our cucumbers, and that's a really big early season thing. So in October, one of the main things we're selling is cucumbers, and Helene wiped all that out. So we had a GoFundMe for that, and maybe at the end I can mention that. But it really did hit us economically pretty hard. And of course, I mean, actually, not of course, probably some people don't realize that our growing season here, since we're selling things from Europe primarily, a lot of us European descended, our season is over the winter, so it's fall and then ends in the spring. And so the hurricane season hit us really hard in October, November, and that was the beginning of our season, so it set us back. So that was a real challenge.
Yeah, so you have to wait for the ground to dry out a bit, replant everything. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you have enough seed, I guess. There's likely an issue with that, I would think. I'm small scale. I have a little tower garden. So, you know. But, it's really hard. And how are they recovering now at Jessica's?
Oh, we've had, you know, 8 different plantings since then. So we plant every week or two, you know, a whole round of stuff. So yeah, it's going quite well. Now we're you know, it's season and we're selling like crazy.
Oh, that's good to hear. And in case you're just tuning in, you are listening to the Healthy Living Hour. I'm here with Andrew Hudson of Jessica's Organic Farm. And this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Back to the organic farming What are some things that you feel we're doing really well here locally? I mean, and not just specific to Jessica's, because you travel, you're kind of all over the states somewhat. And what do you see as really good, and what areas do you feel can be improved upon?
Oh, so you mean here in the Sarasota Bradenton area?
Sure, anywhere.
Well, we have a really thriving farmers market, so we have a really good way to engage the public. And I think farmers markets can't be overemphasized there, because there are multiple good things all happening at once. You have the access to good food, like there are two different really good bakeries who have stands at the farmers market. There are a whole bunch of different good things that you can get access to. And then with everything going online, culturally, creating a public space like that is more and more important. And also a shout out to WSLR in Fogartyville, which is also super important. They physically invite people together. I mean, as a person who produces food for people, I do that partially because I believe in physical wellness. You know, our minds and our bodies are not separate things. We can't just do everything online. We need to be together. So yeah, that's something that Sarasota does really well. I mean, you go to this farmer's market, I assume you've been there.
Oh, yeah.
And
we look forward to it every weekend.
Yeah,
you look forward to it.
It really draws you, doesn't it?
The energy, the vibration is high. You just want to be there, and you can't be sad. You can't be angry walking around there. You're just happy because people are happy there.
And this is another thing that I think should be said over and over, because it's hard to make yourself get out of your house on Saturday morning, maybe. So everybody get out and go to the farmer's market or come to Jessica's. We're open 3 days a week. So we have our own stand. We on and off have relationships with other people who sell at the farmer's market. So you might be able to get our stuff downtown. Warden is one of our sister farms. We're big fans. We're not competitors. We've got this synergy. So if you buy from Warden, we are happy. Yeah, I think that's something that Sarasota does really well. And then there's stuff that isn't as strong as it used to be, but is still there, which is a very strong movement to buy locally and to transition to something that is more sustainable. So we have an organization that's now called Community Harvest. It used to be called Transition Sarasota. We also have Sunshine Community Composting, and there are several nonprofits that work in different ways to help this become a more robust place.
Yeah, and you brought up Sunshine Community Composting, and I just want to mention, I see it's still out there, but they actually have a compost bin in the back by Fogartyville. The parking
right
by the door there. Yeah, so I actually had some stuff, you know, life gets in the way, and then you're like, oh no, my you know, stuff's not looking too good. It's just past that cook time. And you don't want to throw it away. I don't want to throw it away. We can make good soil from this organic food, you know, as a way not to be so wasteful.
Yeah, and to start taking the linear concept of waste out of how we think, and to start thinking circularly that, okay, we're not wasting this. We're part of a circle of things regenerating. And if I can just use that as a transition, I mentioned that there are alternatives to organic as like organizing concepts. The number one that I would throw out there to sort of synergize with the organic concept is regenerative. And you were just doing some regenerative thinking. Okay, this is not waste. This is not something that's just reached an endpoint. This is something, and anytime we have something, it can become something else, right? And so for gardening, or one thing I like about the term organic or regenerative is it doesn't have a lot of cultural baggage yet. The term organic, you know, it can be the butt of jokes. It can be, you know, there's just so much that goes with that. And it's a huge industry. Regenerative the concept itself, I think, shows through the word. And that's something I would really encourage people to think about if they're gardening, is how can this be regenerative? How can I have the sum total of what I do in a year, leave it better a year from now than where it is now? And not be so purist about this or that particular thing I'm adding. You know, like, there is a very small but meaningful role for pesticides. There's a tiny role for, you know, these toxins. And if you're doing a regenerative garden, you can do something quote unquote wrong as long as you're leaving it better a year from now than it is now. You know, and don't get me wrong, we don't use pesticides. We don't, we don't use chemicals at Jessica's, but just that guiding thing, I think, helps people get out of the paralysis of thinking, okay, I have to figure out how to do it perfectly before I even start. And it just lets you get out there and, okay, this year is going to be better than last year. And then next year's going to be the same thing.
It's compassionate and forgiving.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I like that. And too, you know, talking about eating local, like what we have here, and you talked about a lot of us being of maybe European descent or other descent. And I know, like, our ancestors, maybe yours and mine, they didn't grow up eating blueberries from Ecuador in February.
Right.
You know, there's a thing to that. We need to eat local, what's in season. There's so much value of that. And I always found it, in the last however many years or over a decade, getting into more of the local grown food, you know, or getting the consumer sourced agriculture boxes that we used to be able to get, you know, oh, what is this alien in the box? I need to look this up and see what I need to do with it. You know, and it was fun. You're not just making the same things all the time, and you get creative. And we need that. I think humans, we thrive on that. We need that artistic portion as well to our mundane
day. You know, it's really funny. And that's how I got started too, in Portland with the CSA and the farmer, you know, and this is before email, but the farmer would have a little flyer in with your box and saying, okay, that funny looking thing is fennel. Mm-hmm. And here are a couple recipes, you know. And so that was how I got introduced to fennel. And there's a really funny thing about creativity with cooking, especially. You know, we've all had the experience of you have some raw stuff and you're like, oh my gosh, I gotta cook this, and then you put some creativity into it, and by the end you have more energy than you started with. There's this lack of math about how the whole thing works. So I just love that. And it's, you know, you just got to say it over and over. It's worth the effort to cook with really good food.
It's worth the effort. And, you know, I come from a pretty robust line of genetics. My grandfather just turned 100 in October. He still lives home alone on the family farm. He cooks. He grows a garden. At 99, this past summer, he grows a garden.
Wow.
And he gardens, and he's cooking, you know. He's like, Becky, you know how many potato pancakes you can make out of two potatoes? Six. You know, I get these little nuggets from him. I wish I could spend more time at the feet of the elders, you know, with that wisdom. But, you know, and then my great-grandmother, she never drove. She never had a driver's license. She would just walk to the grocery store. And she was a school cook, K through 12, in a small town. I don't know how many, you know, one class per grade. So maybe had 20 some students in a grade, you know, and everybody's in a building K through 12. And she was the school cook, and it wasn't from Cisco. It was all home cooked food. And there's, like, you know, we have vitamin D, vitamin, all the B's. And I feel like, wow, I mean, in reflecting on that, my realization, she put vitamin L, her love, her heart, her caring in this food. And I think that's what's missing. We're so busy and we're so convenienced to death in this society and go, go, go. And there's so much stress and pressure. And, you know, we just make something out of a package or something quick and easy. But there's that artistic portion and creativity and just the heart aspect, the spirit of the heart that goes into cooking for people you care about. It's a different type of nourishment.
Yeah. Yeah, vitamin L is a real thing.
It's a real thing, for sure. Leon, would you tell people about our listener survey, please?
Absolutely. So happy 20th anniversary to our community. For 2 decades, your support has made everything we do possible. And now we want to hear from you. So please take a moment to fill out our 2025 listener survey and help shape the future of WSLR. It's quick and easy. Just visit WSLR.org and click the banner on the homepage. Thank you for 20 incredible years.
Oh, thanks, Leon. I know I, for one, was blown away at, you know, coming in to do a little health and wellness program. And what an amazing group. What an amazing pile of people this is. You know, it's really just become like a family. I love my family, don't get me wrong, but I this is my a family of choice here. And I just am so appreciative for the opportunity and just grateful for, you know, the different people I meet and the backgrounds, and it's just so rich. It's just such a blessing. Anyway, we're back with Andrew Hudson here. Again, our studio lines are open, 941-954-8636, if you have any questions for Andrew today. And Andrew, back to this organic thing. We had talked a little bit prior about the importance of greens. Mm. You know, green foods. And could you share your thoughts on this?
I can. I have a sort of off the cuff. No, it's not off the cuff. I don't know the scientific backing of what I'm going to talk about. But this is either scientific or it's my experience, and it's a good myth. But I experience eating greens as this really invigorating thing. And it's another one of those things I sort of have to make myself do, but I'm always glad that I do. And, you know, as I'm walking around the farm, I can just grab a leaf of kale or, you know, a small head of lettuce or something to eat it. I read somewhere, and I've looked this up a couple times, that chlorophyll, the essence of greens, is very, very similar to hemoglobin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the plant blood.
It's the plant blood.
Yeah.
And it acts in our own blood a little bit like a blood transfusion. And it's just this shot of life. And so when I eat chlorophyll, I notice that I am just more invigorated. I just have more of my essence or something. So that's something I just like to emphasize to people is just make a snack of eating a leaf of kale or, you know, a little lettuce or something. And one of my favorite things to do is to make a kale shot. So to run some kale through a juicer and just come up with an ounce of just kale juice. And it's bitter, and it's a little bit like drinking a shot of alcohol, which also doesn't taste good. So you might as well just drink a shot of kale juice. And it just like if people appreciate, which I love whiskey, okay? I like the really deep taste involved in whiskey. Kale also has a really deep taste. Okay, so it's bitter on the surface, but there's this real incredible depth to it. So it's actually kind of similar to me. And don't get me wrong, if I'm out with people, I don't have a shot of kale juice, okay, at a bar or whatever. But it is kind of similar to me, like sip a shot of kale juice. So, you know, however people get it in them, chlorophyll is an amazing thing.
It is. It is. I'll have to try to do a program on that someday, mm-hmm. some research. And yeah, that's great. But because, if you look, you look at what our kids are eating. Again, it's just bland. There's no rich colors there. You know, nothing rich. It's just like bread, that's white, brown, French fries, white, brown. I mean, that's a potato. But, you know, we're really missing all those plant phytonutrients mm-hmm. that our bodies thrive on. We need it for mitochondrial function, for our detoxification pathways. So, hey, how about let's ask a better why, like what we can do better instead of, you know, just eating, you know, just because it's there. And then after the holidays, when we, you know, we know we've overdone it in many areas, perhaps. But, and then doing a big detox program. I need to do a liver detox or this detox or that detox. That's kind of expensive. And who knows how healthy they are. We don't do those in my practice very often. We don't need to. It's about teaching people how to eat, because you're doing that naturally every day with your food. You can. It's possible to do that more. So we need that. And we need our kids. You know, we're losing a healthy patient population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, oh, I'd like to share a story. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but, you know, in learning nutritional medicine, one of my first experiences of stories goes back to the 1930s. There was a Dr. Pottinger, Francis Pottinger. Do you know of the Pottinger's cats? Yeah, it's really interesting. No. So he and his family, they had like a sanatorium for tuberculosis patients in California. And they were seeing things at the time where the food was starting to change. They were pasteurizing, homogenizing the milk, you know, the meat was kind of changing, the animal products. And so he basically, my understanding, and you can find this anywhere on the internet, there's books, but he basically took cats, because they have a relatively short lifespan, and he started, giving like two sets, giving certain sets the, you know, processed portion of the food, and then keeping another one clean, organic. And what he noticed that after just a few generation of these cats, that the cats on the, the cooked and adulterated foods were arthritic, neurotic, infertile. And then it, you know, I mean, that's kind of what we have going on in our society, I think, well, you know, an overabundance of. And what he noticed is that just changing their food back to the way it was meant to be, they got healthy cats again. It just took a few generations.
Yeah, and it's just interesting. I imagine there could be somebody out there who listened to what you just said and would think, oh, that's an overgeneralization. You're talking about going back as if it's all one thing. But I just want to sort of testify for myself that I have, 20 years ago, I put a lot of effort into being vegetarian, and I'm still vegetarian. I was vegan for a while, and, you know, I still eat dairy sometimes. I, for a while, really watched how I combined things and, you know, tried to make sure I had all the vitamins and all that. And now I don't. I do not watch what the different combinations are. I just make sure I have good food. And that is ample. And I'm one of the most active people I know. It's my job to be out on the farm and model, here's how you mulch, you know, like I lead a very physical lifestyle. So it's not like I'm able to be some scrawny vegetarian, you know, on the margins of society. Like, I'm out leading, here's how we do this. And I don't say that to brag. I just want people to know that what you were talking about really is doable, even for people who exercise a lot or in some other way need a kind of high nutrition level. As long as you eat a broad array of foods, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, a broad array of foods. That's where it's at. And years ago, Dr. Michael Pollan, I believe, he has the book Food Rules.
R-U-L-E-S. Okay, I haven't read that one.
Oh, yeah, but it's basically, what, 7 or 8 words. Eat real food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah.
And in all the current medical research, it's all going plant-based diet, plant-based diet, plant-based diet. Do you really have to be vegetarian or vegan? Maybe not. You know, it's a choice for many of us, but that's where the research is heading. They know that we're lacking these things. And a broader array of, you know, colors. A lot of people have digestive issues. And one thing we do in our clinic and encourage people to do that are struggling with this is, we call it veggie mash or, you know, and mashup. Dr. Tatis Karazi, and he's kind of the father of functional medicine or one of them, but you know, this is his idea. There's YouTube videos on it. It's a great thing. It's a great thing to start implementing in children if you're trying to make these changes in them. And basically what he says is this: get a wide array, get a red pepper, some green kale, like whatever, yellow squash, just get a nice array of colors, nutrient dense, some spinach, this, that, you know, some of the sweeter things too. Throw it all in your good high-end blender, zhuzh that up, maybe put it in some ice cube trays, freeze it, you know, put it in some little bags in the freezer, and then you can take those little ice cubes, you can just let them thaw, and, you know, you can just eat it if you're trying to make a good impact, because it'll have those prebiotic, probiotics in there, you know, that natural plant medicine. And or you can cook with it, throw it in your soup. So it's just such an easy, doable thing. Mm-hmm. And I started utilizing that too, you know, at home. Like, oh, this is starting to go. I better, you know, get this in the freezer in my little veggie mashup. So just a little interjection there. And Andrew, we need another hour on this. But let's talk about your other endeavor, Sabbath gardening. Can you share that with us, please?
Sure. So I've been involved in churches. I'm Mennonite, and I went to seminary. I'm now a pastor. But I'm not looking to practice leading one church. I'm looking to help congregations get in touch with the land where they have been worshiping. I believe that for spiritual communities, not just Christian, but spiritual communities, especially in America, tend to have a giant blind spot. The Native Americans, pretty much everywhere, there are almost no generalizations you can make about indigenous people. But one thing you can say about almost all of them is they think of land as sacred, and they think of us belonging to a place, not just the place belonging to us. That's really important. Wisdom that I think we ignore at our peril. And I believe that the climate crisis we're going through is largely a spiritual crisis of not recognizing that we need to belong to a place and that the earth is sacred. And this, by the way, is very encoded in the Bible. So I'm not just making this up as some liberal, you know, scheme here. That's what I did in seminary. I studied the passages about the earth in the Bible, as my kind of theme throughout the 4 years there. And so now I've come up with a model for gardening I call Sabbath gardening, borrowing from ideas from the Bible, where people can do gardens. People are familiar with gardens. They're non-threatening. This is not you have to do it a certain way. But you can use gardening as a way to begin getting in touch with this land that most people have never even thought of as a sacred site. Mm. And yet it is a sacred site because that's where their community meets. And so I want to invite people to use gardening in whatever way they feel led to do, but I've got some supports for that.
Well, yeah, wonderful. And, you know, it. I love how you have a YouTube little 3 or 4 minute video on this, and I love how you talk about tradition and justice, you know, and those tenets are embedded in this philosophy and this hopefully new movement.
Yeah, can I just give a concrete example of that? So there are so many ways you can take things in the Bible. There are really good agricultural practices in the Bible. So you're supposed to every 7 years let the land be fallow. It's a bit like fasting, you know, and when we were talking about nutrition, I just wanted to give a shout out to fasting. There's so much wisdom in our bodies. If we just give them a break, they often balance themselves and our minds, our cravings start to go away. It just kind of resets. So fasting is this amazing thing that's in a lot of spiritual traditions too. Fallow time is a bit like letting your land fast. Just stop pushing it, you know? We just push our land too hard. And I got to admit, at Jessica's, we push it too hard. And I'm trying to figure out how we can have a little more spaciousness there. With Sabbath gardening, what you do is you divide a garden into 7 parts, and then you let 1/7 rest every year. And that's not what I was trying to tell you, but I do want to just mention that that's something anybody can do. You can divide a garden into seven parts and just let one seventh rest every year. It'll be so much better for the garden. People can look up the YouTube. Maybe you can put that in the show notes or something.
Absolutely.
One other idea, just we talked about justice, and it's so easy for this kind of stuff, especially in liberal circles, to sort of congratulate ourselves that we're doing something good and become very self-absorbed. And of course, a lot of churches, like to just speak to my own tradition, we can be very self-absorbed. And justice, that flies in the face of a lot of what's in the Bible, which is about justice. So we've got the idea of tithing. And what if you took one-tenth of your garden and you set that aside to be a gift to somebody in the community, especially some poor folks? So most communities have a low-income housing area, you know, you can, and they might have a meeting once a month. And I did this in outside of Chicago where I was in seminary. Went to a meeting in the off-season of a low-income housing cooperative, said, if we grew some vegetables, what would you want us to grow? You know, if we're going to offer something to you. And they said, cucumbers, greens, and tomatoes. So in our tenth, in our tithing area, we grew cucumbers, greens, and tomatoes. And if you're going to have a plot in our community garden, you have to also help out with the tithing area. So it's all of us tithing with our time to grow that food. And over the course of that growing season, we grew over 500 pounds of produce.
Oh, wow.
And we weekly would take it and just go knock on doors and just like in a very real way say, would you like some? You know, some people say no, some people say yes. You sort of begin to build relationships. Now, I did this where I was at grad school. I would love to see people do this in neighborhoods. And then you actually get outside of your little religious group and start to make real relationships with people. And I believe that that fulfills some of what Jesus wanted. So you know, I think it goes pretty deep, but it's actually pretty simple.
Wow, yeah. And that, you know, again, that circles back to what WSLR and Fogarty was about. Fogartyville is all about building community, mm-hmm. integrating community, making all people feel welcome so that nobody is left out. And I just love that. And Andrew, oh gosh, I want to get you back soon before you trail off for the summer. But, you know, can you please share where, if people want more information, maybe the GoFundMe, where is Jessica's Farm for those who don't know of it? How do they access it? What days is it open? How do they find you? How do they connect with you? And also, you know, all those things.
Yeah. There's a couple different things. So all things Jessica's can be found at the website, jessicasorganicfarm.com. If you do a web search, it comes up easily. So just go to the website. It is a little complicated, even though it's not very far. The farm is about halfway between downtown Sarasota and the UTC Mall. Mm-hmm. So it's within town. The city grew out past us. We were there first.
Yes.
But now the city grew out past us. So there's a map on the website. There's also something about the GoFundMe, which is ongoing.
On the website?
On the website.
Perfect.
Yeah. If you go up to go to GoFundMe.com, you can actually look up Jessica's on that too. So, it's really all managed through the website. Jessica's farm stand is open Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We love to have people come. We have about 400 customers a month, or a week, 400
wow,
people
that's
a
wonderful.
Week. So it's a busy, very vibrant thing.
And how do people find you, please?
And how you find me is sabbathgardening@gmail.com.
Oh, perfect. Andrew, thank you so much for being here. What a great conversation. I hope everyone listening got something useful out of it. And again, you're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Tune in next Tuesday for our environmental program with Julian Jano right here, same bat station, bat time on Your Changing Environment. And in the meantime, please stay tuned for Democracy Now!